Now, there's something I'd like to ask. If you do it, you'll find you get along a lot better with all kinds. You see, you never really understand a person until you consider things from his point of view. You know, climb into his skin and walk around in it. You want to be a lawyer, don't you? Then learn to understand the other's position. It's one of the first rules of law. And you can start by remembering that Mr. Radley's name is Arthur, not Boo.
That's a scene from a stage adaptation of Harper Lee's famous novel, To Kill a Mockingbird. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
Harper Lee's novel, To Kill a Mockingbird, published in 1960, became a bestseller and won a Pulitzer Prize for fiction. A film version starring Gregory Peck as Atticus, the courageous lawyer who defends a wrongly accused black man in Alabama, won 3 Academy Awards in 1962. Why does the story endure? How is the current stage version being performed in Madison by CTM Madison Family Theater like and unlike the novel and the movie? Joining us to talk about the staging of To Kill a Mockingbird is Roseanne Sheridan, director of To Kill a Mockingbird for CTM Madison Family Theater. And also with us in the studio are 5 of the actors from the cast. Richard Gandung, you just heard, as Atticus. Emma Geer as Scout. Monica Lyons as the mature Jean Louise Finch, or Scout. Kenny Lyons as Jem. And Caleb Sullivan as Dill.
And welcome one and all to University of the Air. Happy to have you here. To Kill a Mockingbird, you know, it's already a classic, but it hasn't been out that long, 1960, and yet it's, you know, reached the top of many lists of the finest books. I think the Library Journal voted it as its best novel of the 20th century, if not of all time. What is it about this really relatively simple story, whether in book form or play form, that really makes it so potent?
Well, I think one of the things is that it's a very rich character study and story about life in the South of America. So it's a very American sort of story, and it includes a historical perspective on our culture and on our time. And there are people and characters in the play that everyone relates to, and a kind of community feeling that I think sort of epitomizes Americana.
Harper Lee is kind of a fascinating, enigmatic figure. You'd expect she would have gone on to write her second bad novel, like other writers who go on after having a bestseller to write something bad, but she seems to have stopped with this one novel. Can you tell us something about Harper Lee, her background, and the extent to which this story is somewhat autobiographical?
Well, clearly she drew a lot on her own life and on her story and the people that she lived with, and I don't know her personally because she's not really come out very much to talk to other people. But she's a wonderful study in sort of a study in success. You know, she wrote this novel, and that's all she really wanted to say about life in her time or her world. Yeah,
maybe she has a little bit of Boo Radley in her, a little bit of the recluse.
It does seem that way. Although recently she did come out just a few years ago and went and attended a production that was done in Alabama with a white high school and a predominantly black high school, and they came together to do this production. It was one of the few times that she's actually been seen out in public.
She had a wonderful sense of humor. I mean, she became very good friends with Gregory Peck, who of course played the part of Atticus in the film, and he had one story about her that makes it sound like she was anything but, reclusive, eccentric. He was filming the movie, and after one scene, he noticed she was over on the sidelines, and she had tears in her eyes. And he went over to her and said, Harper, I couldn't help noticing you had tears in your eyes. Are you okay? And she said, oh, it's just that my daddy had a little pot belly just like yours.
Yes.
Yeah. So she clearly has that sense of humor still.
And didn't she have a cameo in the movie Capote recently? I think she was in the background or something in that film recently.
And he's supposed to be the model a little bit for Dill, right?
Definitely, yeah. There's so many parallels. I mean, the research material for the show, for the play, and for the novel, of course, is, there's immediate parallels, like the Scottsboro trials with the 9 African-American men that were put on trial accused of raping 2 white women, and Monroeville, Alabama. In fact, one of the tapes that I had to help us with the dialect was produced in conjunction with a show that was going to be done of To Kill a Mockingbird down in Alabama, and they interviewed people that lived in Monroeville. And you know, you can just see where all of those parallels came for the characters that are in the story.
Completely plausible. I mean, the whole premise of the story, right out of the newspapers from any number of places in the South at that time.
Right. And such a brilliant choice of Harper Lee's to take in 1960 to be writing a story, but setting it in 1935, because at that time the volatility of everyone's emotions, you know, was so high that if she had set it in that time and tried to illustrate it through some recent example of a case or some sort of riot or something like that, I don't think that people could have had the emotional distance to receive it as well as they did. But because right. it had that the distance of looking back on it.
And then there's the child's point of view, too, which if you're seeing a story through the innocent, not always comprehending, but very truthful kind of perspective of a child, it changes how an audience would see it. Now, in your production, you've got both the young scout and an older version functioning as narrator. Can you say something about those two roles and then help set up a scene for us?
Sure. Even in the movie, you hear the voice of the older scout. She's rather narrating, you know, talking about her life and all that. And likewise, Christopher Sergel is the playwright who adapted the novel into the play. And with the blessing of Harper Lee, because he met with her and she saw the adaptation that he did and gave him the vote of approval. So in this play, I thought it was important that we continue to have that sort of perspective of both the young girl growing up and the more mature woman looking back on her life. And we've all had that experience of looking back at a certain time of our lives, a certain kind of relationships that we had or something like that. So in the play, every now and then, the older scout watches the action and sometimes participates in it and sometimes helps bridge it from one time to another, one scene to another, that kind of thing.
I'm trying to remember how the book is framed. Is it told as a first-person narrative from that distance?
It is.
So this is quite in keeping with that.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And that was important to me that in fact, many times we went back to the novel, and because she has such rich detail, he dug his foot into the dirt. He took off his glasses and cleaned them. She looked over her right shoulder. I mean, she's got all that detail, and it's fun to kind of include that in the production where it works theatrically, too.
Although the sort of central dramatic, I guess, point of the book has to do with the trial of the wrongly accused black man, there's a lot of scenes that have to do with Boo Radley.
Well, Boo Radley is, I think, for me, is sort of the contemporary core of the story, because Boo Radley represents the things and the people and the ideas that we're afraid of, you know. And kids, there's always sort of that mysterious person or somebody, you know, that the house that nobody wants to go by. But it's really about that distancing, like that imagining of something that you don't know anything about. And recently with the whole episode with Don Imus and his comments about the Rutgers women's basketball team, when those women basketball players were asked what they wanted as a result of that, they said they wanted to meet with him so that that he could get to know them as individuals like himself. So that kind of bridging of what keeps us separate from each other. And so the parallel, of course, thematically and dramatically in the play is what's keeping the white community separate from being able to understand and accept that this could not have happened or that someone might be falsely accused and things like that. But Boo Radley is a great, in fact, the first act is really driven around him and Dill's arrival in this town. His aunt lives in Macomb and he's come to stay with her for the summer, and he sneaks over to the kids' house and notices them, and then they notice him and he learns about who Boo Radley is.
Jim and I waited all school year for summer to arrive. Summer was our best season. Summer was sleeping in the back screen porch and cots or trying to persuade Atticus to let us sleep in the treehouse. Summer was everything good to eat. It was a thousand colors on a parched landscape. And that summer was also Dill.
Hey.
Hey yourself. I'm Charles Baker Harris. Folks call me Dill. I can read.
So what?
Just thought you'd like to know. You got anything needs reading, I can do it. I'm staying for the summer with my Aunt Rachel.
You're sort of puny.
I'm little, but I'm old.
That was one of Dill's favorite expressions. He was from Meridian, Mississippi. We came to know Dill as a pocket Merlin whose head teemed with eccentric plans, strange longings, and quaint fancies.
How old's your father?
I haven't got one.
Is he dead? Our mother's dead.
No.
Well, if he's not dead, you've got one, haven't you?
Never mind her, Dill.
If his father isn't dead, how can he say he hasn't got one? How?
My daddy has a black pointed beard and runs L&M Railroad.
Is that so?
I help the engineer run the train whenever I want.
Dill Harris could tell the biggest ones I ever heard.
Do you want to see what I found? Indian heads.
Indian heads? Where'd you get those? Let me see them.
I found them in the knot hole. Look at the dates. 1906 and 1900.
Indian heads? They're real strong magic and bring you good luck.
Not from the Radley tree, they won't.
Wow, what's wrong with the Radley?
Shh! Well, for one thing, there's a boy named Boo who's been locked up in that house yonder for 30 years.
30 years? How come?
He got in trouble when he was a boy, so his daddy locked him up in that house, and he hasn't been seen since.
Boo Radley was a legend in Maycomb. The story went that when he was a boy in his teens, he took up with some bad ones from Old Sarum. They were arrested on charges of disorderly conduct and disturbing the peace. The judge sentenced the boys to the state industrial school. Boo Radley was released to his father, who shut him up in that house, and he wasn't seen again for more than 15 years.
Once, Boo was sitting in the living room with scissors, cutting pictures out of the paper, when his daddy walked in. Boo stabbed those scissors right into his daddy's leg, pulled him out, wiped him on his jeans, and went right back to cutting. The judge wanted to send him to an asylum, but his father said no Radley was going to any asylum. So there he is to this day, sitting in there with his scissors. Who knows what he's doing or thinking?
How do you know he's still in there?
I seen his tracks in our backyard many a morning. And one night, I heard him scratching on our back screen.
Wonder what he looks like.
Judging from his tracks, he's about 6.5 feet tall. He eats squirrels and any cats he can catch. What teeth he has are yellow and rotten. His eyes pop, and most of the time, he drools.
Let's make him come out.
Make Boo Radley come out?
Are you crazy? You want to get yourself killed, all you got to do is go up and knock on that door.
You're scared. Too scared to put your big toe in the front yard.
I ain't scared. I'm just respectful.
I dare you.
You dare me?
Don't do it, Jim. No one's ever been inside the gate.
Well?
Don't hurry me.
Just touch the house. I dare you.
Just touch the house is all.
Yeah, that's all. Scout me is right behind you. Someone's at the window. Look at the curtains.
Run! He was watching. He saw me.
Don't ever do that again.
Let's throw a pebble against the door. As soon as he sticks his head out, we'll say we want to buy him an ice cream. That'll seem friendly. Maybe he'll feel better.
How do you know he don't feel good now?
How would you feel if you'd been shut up for 100 years with nothing but cats to eat? Of course, if you'd rather I threw the pebble.
You better leave it to me.
You're not going to throw a pebble at the Radley house.
Jim?
Atticus.
Atticus.
Just what were you about to do, Jim?
Nothing, sir.
I don't want any of that. You tell me.
I was going to throw a pebble at the Radley house to make Boo come out.
Why?
Because, sir, I'm Charles Baker Harris. Folks call me Dill. I can read. I'm staying for the summer with my Aunt Rachel. Well, we thought Mr. Radley might enjoy us and, well...
I see. Well, nice to meet you, Mr. Harris. I'm sure you'll be a welcome addition to the neighborhood for Jim and Scott. Now I want to tell y'all something and tell you one time. Don't bother that man.
But why doesn't he ever...
What Mr. Radley does is his own business. How'd you like it if I barged into your rooms at night without knocking?
Well, that's different.
Is it?
We're not crazy.
What Mr. Radley does may seem peculiar to us, but it does not seem peculiar to him.
But anyone who stays inside all the time...
That's his business. Oh, there's Cunningham.
I got a much better plan. See you.
Regardless of any plans, you ought to stay away from that house unless invited, hmm?
That's such a great scene. And I think what I'd like to do is ask each of you that we heard in that scene just to say a little bit about what you thought of the, what your conception is of the character you're playing and what you've learned from playing the part. Let's start with you, Emma Geer, who played the young Scout in this scene. Can you tell us something about how you see Scout?
I see her just as I think a lot of people see her. She's spunky and she's a lot of fun, but at the same time, she's very innocent, and that's kind of what makes the play so emotional and the book so emotional, and how she really grows up all the way through this book and this story over the summer, learning about Tom Robinson and the trial and Boo and everybody.
So have you read the book?
I've read parts of it, not the whole way through, I'm afraid, yeah.
Well, you seem to have a great grasp of where the character is coming from.
Thank you.
And then, of course, there's Dill, played by Caleb Sullivan. You seem a little full of yourself sometimes. Tell us about Dill.
Is that what we call typecasting?
Well, Dill is sort of this fun-loving kid who doesn't really get very much love at home. And so he just sort of lives in this fantasy world. And she just escaped from the real world when he's feeling sad or whatever. But when he comes over to make home, and then he meets Atticus, and then Atticus is what he's always wanted in his parents. And so he's just ecstatic. Of course, he gets to meet Scout and Jem, and they become great friends.
So he has a lot going on in this play. There's a lot to keep up with. That's still a dynamic character.
Yeah.
You see him constantly growing as we go through this play.
Well, actually, he's sort of more mentally mature than... like Scout or possibly Jem.
You're buying that as playing Scout? Or are we going to have a whole other show that we're going to have to do here?
Debate.
Well, let's turn to Jem, the older brother of Scout. And I know we're going to hear you in a later scene as well. Jem, played by Kenny Lyons, what can you tell us about your character?
Well, I think Jem is pretty much your average troubled teen. He is your average teenager. He's got his spats with his parents. He is protective of his younger sister in multiple scenes when she's being yelled at by a crotchety old lady from across the street. So he's very protective. He, even though he's having spats with his father, Atticus, he loves him very much. He also, he's got the sense of growing up over the summer, and he really, it's his passage of manhood when he experiences the different things over the summer with the trial and facing down a mob of angry farmers with his dad.
And he's also, but he seems, he wants something from his father that his father's not really interested in giving. What we'll hear with the game, you know, the touch football game, and Atticus says, well, I'm just not really into that kind of thing, and he doesn't want to mess with air rifles or rifles of any kind. They've got some acquaintance to strike up yet between them, apparently.
Well, yeah, and also later in the scene, you find out that Atticus was one-shot Finch as a boy. He was a dead shot with a gun, but being the kind of man he is, he put down his gun when he realized that, quote, God had given him an unfair advantage over the animals he was hunting. So he doesn't like to deal with guns, and his son is obviously upset by that. But then he watches him shoot a rabid, very sick dog and kills him in one shot. And Jem kind of realizes why his father is not interested in guns, as he says. So that in that scene, they kind of start understanding each other a lot.
Well, and it redefines manhood in a sense.
Yeah.
And in terms of the womanly Scout, the older Scout functioning as narrator, Monica Lyons, what do you do so that there's a sort of bridge between the young Scout and the older Scout?
Well, I get to have that adult perspective of this time in my life that shaped who I was, who I am today. And I get to watch, you know, the younger version of myself taking all of these events in and dealing with them and processing them. And then, as, you know, theatrically, I get to tell the audience what it meant to me.
You get a little bit of irony in there where you're seeing these things from a distance.
Irony and also poignancy. So,
well, I don't know, nostalgia is not quite an adequate word, but you do have this film of looking through to the past.
Definitely. And you know, how you process it as an adult versus what you've done with it as a child are sometimes two very different things. So as an actor, it's been nice to try and find that balance.
We're going to be hearing more from To Kill a Mockingbird when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach, and our guests, Roseanne Sheridan, the director of the CTM production of To Kill a Mockingbird, and also we have cast members here as well. The play, like the book by Harper Lee, is really about many things, but I suppose the most immediately conspicuous, if you look at the heart of the story, is that trial and the whole issue of race in this town in Alabama in 1935. What is the play saying about race, and how contemporary is it?
Well, it certainly says a lot about prejudices and bigotries that can be held between races, and primarily it's certainly looking at it through a white American, Caucasian American perspective, historical perspective. There was, because it's set in 1935, lynchings were common. There was a great deal of division. Like one of the things we noticed in it is that I didn't even know, one of the lines in the trial, Tom Robinson says, "I felt sorry for her." And in regards to why he was helping out the young...
His accuser,
right. They say to him, what were you doing in there? Why did you walk across there? You know, why did you go into the yard? And she invited me in. Why were you helping her? And he says, you know, I felt sorry for her. It seemed like nobody else helped her. Well, just to say he felt sorry for a white person was enough to put him away at that time, because it was a breach of... what was
the class distinction?
Class distinction, you know, what would be deemed to be respectful. But, you know, Harper Lee is really interesting how she's woven into the fabric of the piece bigotries at a lot of different levels. There's the sort of the stereotype of the white trash, you know, and how people talk about that family.
The family of the accuser.
Of the accuser.
Her father in particular.
Right, right. And they say, oh, well, everybody knows what kind of place the Yules are, you know. And so people make comments like that. And then earlier on in the play, the reverend of the black church, the First Purchase Church, comes to visit their house, the Finch's housekeeper, and some townspeople come by, the Yules actually come by the house, walk past the house. They stop talking. They drop their head down. They turn away. You know, so we see this illustration of behavior and expectations and common practices and all that. And then when we get to the trial scene, one of the things we've noticed is that there seems to be this buzz of excitement about this trial scene initially. It's almost like gladiator entertainment.
Sure.
But then as it goes on, the audience that's watching the trial, the townspeople that are watching, and in this production I've added in a number of townspeople to be watching, they actually get very quiet and very still because something starts happening they're not prepared for.
A reversal of some kind.
That's right. That's right. It's not all neatly tied up. I mean, she doesn't, you know, just tie the whole thing up and say, you know, we shouldn't do this, and everybody knows that. In contemporary time, it's hard because I feel like at least most of us want to feel like we've made progress in this area, you know, and that we have more. We don't think that way anymore. We don't act that way anymore. The racial relations are better. And yet, where do they still play out?
But it's not just race, is it? When you look at these prejudices, if you want to call them that, because, I mean, there's, in a sense, there's some prejudice of a kind between Atticus and his son, who doesn't realize that his father is capable of doing more than he is, you know,
right,
with the gun, for example. And there is misconception about Boo Radley.
Absolutely.
You know, is he magical? Is he some kind of a nutcase or what exactly? And they just haven't broken through to make the connections with any of these people.
And there's prejudice against Scout as a girl supposed to be Jean Louise and be ladylike.
Right, so there's lots and lots of points of view, and I think they all sort of bridge to the crux of the trial scene when Atticus talks about what makes us equal. And even he says, we know not everybody's equal because everybody has different qualities, different gifts and different defects, different strengths and different weaknesses. So it's not about that, but it's about respect for all people.
And I know we're going to be hearing that scene in a little bit, the speech on equality. But before we get to that, could we talk about the wonderful conversation between Atticus's children and Atticus about the stand that he has decided to take and the unpopularity of that? Because I think one of the ways that this novel or stage version of it would transcend any time is that feeling that so many children or teenagers might have of, you know, that's great that you're going to do the right thing, mom or dad, but couldn't I just fit in? Couldn't I just do the popular thing?
Yeah, that's one of the things that's really hard for Scout in the play is that she says, the way everybody's going on, you think he was running still. Everybody at school says this, and there's this little scene where we hear people calling her names. And one of the conversations I had with the young people in the cast was, has this kind of thing ever happened to you where you felt like you were singled out or you were ostracized or somebody said something mean to you? And how did you respond to that? And so we talked about that, but yeah, it's one of those things that makes it very immediate to her things. And Jem would like to say, you know, why don't you just stop doing that? Why don't you just not do that? And even right from the beginning, Atticus says he doesn't believe he's going to win it, but he's going to do it anyway. He's going to take the trial on anyway.
Atticus, are we poor?
We are indeed.
As poor as the Cunninghams?
Well, not exactly. The Cunninghams are country folk, farmers. The crash hits them hardest. So what was the trouble with his boy?
He said some things I didn't like. I rubbed his nose in the dirt.
That's not very ladylike. What'd he say?
Things. And I think we should have a talk. I've been waiting for you to come home because...
Atticus, catch!
Hang on. Not today, son.
Atticus, will you be going out for the Methodists? For the football game?
What game?
It's not until fall, but everyone's talking about it already. It's for fundraising. The Methodists challenged the Baptists to a game of touch football.
Afraid I wouldn't be much of a help, Jim.
But everybody's father is playing.
Except yours.
But every other father...
I'll break my neck.
It's touch.
Well, I'm too old for that sort of thing.
Atticus, would you have time to show me and Scout how to shoot our air rifles?
I told you, I'm not interested in guns.
You're not interested in anything.
Atticus... What's rape?
Rape is carnal knowledge of a female by force.
Atticus, do you defend niggers?
Don't say nigger, Scout. That's common.
It's what everybody at school says.
And from now on, it'll be everybody less one.
Atticus, do you defend Negroes?
Yes, I do.
Why do the kids at school make it sound like you're doing something awful?
You aren't old enough to understand some things yet, Scout, but there's been some high talk around town that I shouldn't be doing much about defending Tom Robinson, but I'm going to defend that man.
Well, if they say you shouldn't, why are you doing it?
Well, the main reason is if I didn't defend him, I couldn't really have much respect for myself, could I? You see, every lawyer gets one case in his lifetime that affects him. This one's mine, I guess.
Are we going to win it?
No, honey. Come here, Scout.
Then why?
Just because we were licked 100 years before we got started is no reason for us not to try to win.
You sound like some old Confederate veteran.
Oh, Scout, you might hear some ugly words this summer, but do one thing for me, will you? Keep your head held high and your fists down. No matter what anyone says to you, don't let them get your goat. Try fighting with your head for a change, It's a good one.
This Tom Robinson case must be pretty important.
It's about right and wrong.
Suppose you're wrong about it.
How's that?
Most people think that they're right and you're wrong.
Well, they're entitled to think that, and they're entitled to full respect for their opinions. But one thing does not abide by majority rule, honey, and that's your conscience.
It does seem as if Atticus is the true moral center of this story. Playing Atticus, do you almost start to feel, Richard Ganong, as if you're saintly or more than human? I mean, does Atticus ever screw up or do anything wrong in this play?
Boy, that's a tough one. Coming into it, you know that Atticus is this towering figure. He is this moral center, but personally, as an actor, you can't play that, right? So what I have to focus on is playing a father, playing a lawyer, a neighbor, just someone who's part of this town whose unfortunate job it is, you know, is to stand up and to have to defend this man. Not that that is an unfortunate thing that he's doing, but it presents an unfortunate situation for the
whole
town.
Why do you suppose this was Gregory Peck's favorite role of all of his movie roles?
Who? I heard you guys talking earlier. I didn't know there was a movie.
This guy that wore the white suit and the glasses, yeah.
Of course, I have seen it. And his work is amazing because it's effortless. It's there. You cannot see the acting. So, yeah, trying to fill those shoes, not Gregory's, Atticus's,
right.
And our Atticus's, is a real difficult task.
What Go do ahead. You do as an actor so that it does seem like a real living Atticus, someone that could have existed and been that way?
And what kind of, for example, what kind of emotional range do you get with this part? Because Atticus seems always to be in control of himself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, I try as hard as I can to listen to my director.
all honestly, on her shoulders.
I do. I trust her because, again, as an actor, first of all, this character is like no other character I've ever played before. His rhythms are quite different from Richard Ganong's own rhythms. So, you know, the slowing it down just a little bit, the learning how to let that emotion out when it is needed, it's teaching me a great deal about stage acting. And also, I honestly mean this, I am growing as a person playing this role. I think that that's a wonderful gift that you get when you're working with such wonderful, well, material. I mean, I came to this first in my own life reading it. And it's funny, I've been asking a lot of my friends, and most of my friends said that they read the novel first before they saw any other version. And again, I love being in that.
Is it different playing to very young people?
First of all, I mean, this really is an incredible cast. I mean, when I was listening to you guys talk about your character descriptions, I was like, wow, I'm so proud of my stage kids. You know,
yeah.
I think the actors that Roseanne has hired may be just a couple years older than the characters themselves, and that's helpful because they have a maturity level. I think it's hard. You can't get a 6 or 7 year old to play a 6 or 7 year old. So they do, all of them have this maturity level beyond the character's age, and they can understand it. I'll never forget Emma one day said, I'm saying such adult words. I know I'm supposed to be a kid, but I'm saying such adult words. And I was like, oh God, that's golden, you know? So it's a treat to
In radio,
that.
Of course, we would just use 50-year-old actors with
high voices.
They're good for years. They can play kids for decades.
Boy, I'm learning a lot. I'm actually learning a lot from these guys. I mean, they are there all the time, ready to go, you know, and they've got their lines, no problem. And sometimes they give me mine. When I forget, I'm like, where are we again? Oh, it's here, Richard. It's like, oh, wow.
I would think there's pressure on to play a classic, one where people have seen Gregory Peck, one where they have read the book, that sort of like doing Hamlet's To Be or Not To Be speech, when you get to these sort of kernels, you know, these chestnuts, it's sort of difficult to make it fresh. As a director, Roseanne, what do you do with the production of To Kill a Mockingbird so that you balance both people wanting to come and see what they've grown to love and also sort of wanting to do something fresh with it?
Well, you know, I always go back to the story, because we tell the story. That's what we do as actors, as directors, as theater people, and as we tell the stories. So I try to stay true to the story. I think that's one of the things that people will see. They'll recognize the story. It'll be in a different form because it's in a theatrical form. One of the things that I have done to this production is I've included some singing. Some choir singing, primarily. I've got some black choirs and a black choir and a white choir, and sometimes they sing together as one choir. And so that's sort of an interesting kind of, I don't know, I wouldn't say it makes it necessarily contemporary, but it certainly it adds another dimension to it. And because it's very immediate, I mean, the actors are right there, and it's a small theater, it's a very intimate environment, so you're really, you know, and I've used a lot of the aisles of the theater, and I have action happening out in the audience. So the audience starts to feel, I hope, right from the beginning, like they're a part of this. They're not holding the book in their hand and able to put it down and go get their coffee, and they're not sitting back and watching the film happen in front of them, but they're actually breathing along with these actors and winding up hopefully feeling a part of the story.
And maybe part of the town.
Right.
Well, yeah, I
right.
can see where they would almost be right caught into the trial scene as
right.
being right. right there in the right. courthouse.
And right from the beginning, the narrator part of the scout grown up looks right at the audience and talks right to the audience. And so there's immediate rapport between the action on stage, and it's been a very conscious choice on my part.
Where do you put her, the elder scout? Is she off to one side?
No,
or
she moves around. You know, she sometimes is sitting on different parts of the stage. Sometimes she's perching near the audience. She moves around a bit as she gets different perspectives on what's happening and different views. And sometimes there's a mirror between her and the young scout. Sometimes they're looking the same direction. Sometimes they're looking at things from different directions. So it's subtle sort of nuances about how they are each watching and letting their lives unfold in front of them or watching them unfold.
Scout has this great line when she's talking to Atticus about the prospects for the trial, and she says, "You sound like some old Confederate veteran, you know, talking about
right.
waging the war anyway."
Right, right. And that's one thing I did want to say, you know, about the having the bridge. I mean, one of the things I love about this production and about working with in the company of CTM in particular is that this bridging of generations, both in terms of the practical elements of mentorship, where you have more mature, I won't say older, actors and artists and younger ones that are not as experienced. But sometimes the younger ones teach all of us, most often they teach us what freshness is and what something that's purely intuitive is, because their imaginations, they haven't quite gotten beyond the self, you know, the stop their imaginations from being the main part of their existence in the world.
So where do you get those young actors anyway?
Well, they're all members of the community in the surrounding areas, and we announce auditions and have classes. The CTM offers classes in acting and in different aspects of the theater, and hopefully people will come and start auditioning and participating, and so we spread the word and gather them together.
And we'll be putting a link to your website off our University of the Air page for people wanting to see the To Kill a Mockingbird in its last weekend, next weekend, and also just to find out more on To Kill a Mockingbird when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
Well now, Miss Scout, still think your father can't do anything? Still ashamed of him?
No, ma'am.
Forgot to mention the other day that he was the deadest shot in Macomb County. When he was a boy, his name was Ol' One-Shot. Something for you to think about, Jim Finch.
I wonder why he never goes hunting now.
If your father's anything, he's civilized. I think maybe he put his gun down when he realized God had given him an unfair advantage.
Looks to me he'd be proud of it.
People like your father never bother about pride in their gifts.
Miss Marty, when Atticus gave me and Jim air rifles, he told us to never shoot mockingbirds. He said it was a sin to kill a mockingbird. Why's that?
Well, I reckon it's because mockingbirds just make music. They don't eat up people's gardens, don't nest in corn cribs. They don't do one thing but sing their hearts out for us.
A scene from an adaptation of Harper Lee's novel To Kill a Mockingbird. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. And our guest this hour, we have Roseanne Sheridan, who is directing the production of To Kill a Mockingbird for CTM Madison Family Theater, running now and also next weekend. And we also have five of the actors from the cast. Emma Geer as Scout, Richard Ganung as Atticus, Monica Lyons as an older Scout, Kenny Lyons as Jem, and Caleb Sullivan as Dill. Roseanne, what do you see as the overriding themes of the play You know, we just heard that beautiful scene that helps us understand the title, mm-hmm. To Kill a Mockingbird. Mm-hmm. What is it that you see as the most important messages?
Well, I think certainly acceptance and understanding of other people and lifestyles and differences and similarities and all of that. And I think also that really what's driving the play and the story is young scouts' point of view. That as a young girl, it's very much a coming-of-age story. It's very much a story about, you know, innocence and then the, I won't say shattering of innocence, but I'll just say what it means to grow up and to notice things as one gets older and starts to see how people treat each other, where the rights are, what feels like right and wrong, and how there's really very little that's black and white, and there's a lot of gray area. But really that notion of being in somebody else's shoes and allowing them to be who they are for all and all that they are.
Is this a play you think that would play differently in one part of the country other than another?
That's a really good question. You know, they just did it down at the Alley Theater in Dallas, and I was very curious as to how it would be received. And I know it was done at the Alabama Shakespeare Festival. I had some friends that worked on a show down there. So closer to home, I think that one thing that might shift a little is some of the humor might be more noticeable. I mean, I think that there's a lot of humor in the play, and there's a lot of it comes out of familiarity. We know these people, we know these characters, we know their kind of town and all that. And I think that perhaps it may be, I think it's a sense that there's sensitivities in every part of the country and in some areas more so than others. One of the things that's happened in the course of this play is there's been some uncomfortable things that are confronted by the actors, particularly some of the younger actors, because of the race relations and because of the language that's used and what's now some words that are really stricken from our vocabulary.
You have to put them back in.
We have to put them back in because that's the way that people talked at that time, and that was the words that they used at that time. And hopefully,
or we're told not to use.
Or we're told not to use, exactly.
Now, a courtroom drama, it just seems to lend itself to the stage anytime you have a trial. Can you say something that helps set up what will happen when people come to see the production?
Sure. One of the driving plot points is that Tom Robinson, a black man, has been accused of raping a white girl. And they talk about it as they talk about everything, each other and people they do and don't know and all that. And so when the second act starts, we begin with Tom being put on trial. And we hear the witnesses that are questioned about the events and on all of that. So we get to see and meet people that in the first act we really pretty much heard about or just met very briefly. So it's a very compelling and active scene, and it culminates in Atticus's speech to the jury, which I find incredibly contemporary in its sensibilities.
In this year of grace, 1935, we're beginning to hear more and more references to Thomas Jefferson's phrase about all men being created equal. Well, we know that all men are not created equal in the sense that some men are smarter than others. Some have more opportunity because they are born with it. Some men make more money. Some ladies make better cakes. Some are born gifted beyond the normal scope, and some are not. But there's one way in which all men are created equal. There's one human institution that makes the pauper the equal to a Rockefeller, the stupid man the equal to an Einstein. That institution, gentlemen, is a court of law. In our courts, all people are created equal. But a court is only as sound as its jury, and its jury is only as sound as those who make it up. I'm confident that you gentlemen will review without passion the evidence you've heard, come to a decision, and restore this defendant to his family. In the name of God, do your duty. In the name of God, believe him.
The thoughts of Atticus Finch in To Kill a Mockingbird. Is it another case of our Confederate veteran going up against what he knows is going to be an unwinnable situation, though? I mean, it is an eloquent speech, you know, so logical and so almost inevitable, and yet.
Right. And how many times do we find that things that we think are like no-brainers, like, oh, that should pass or that should work or that shouldn't happen, still happens.
It makes for great drama, doesn't it, though? I mean, just as in the case of the suspense play where we know that the heroine should not go up to the top of the stairs and open that door
right.
where she's heard the mysterious sounds, but of course she's going to do that.
Right, right, right.
And so inevitably the dice are loaded here.
Yeah. And hopefully in the playing of it, the audience will find themselves, you know, it's kind of like in Romeo and Juliet. You think, maybe this time he'll get there first.
If I watch this thing enough times,
you know?
They'll
maybe he won't drink that potion, you know. But so I think it speaks about hope. That's another really important part, I think, of the play is like, and the story, is that it really is a play about hope. And even in the courtroom, I think at some point we find ourselves going, yeah. Yeah, and in the townspeople watching it, they're changed as a result of that. And in this production, I've been very careful not to be heavy-handed with it and tell people something they may already know, but just allow the experience to take them in and be transported to this scene.
And sometimes people can win even when they lose. You know, win. I mean, we certainly know that Socrates is going to drink the hemlock,
lose
but he can
the battle
win
in the war.
That's
win
right.
In defeat.
That's right.
How does the story of Boo Radley then come together with the story of the trial in a way that ties those two themes?
I think it's more of a oblique parallel, but by the end of the play becomes a more obvious one. I don't know if I'd say obvious, but he's really not addressed in the trial. We're really in that trial scene dealing with the immediate situation. But then the trial sets the tone for a new conflict, which is between Bob Yule and Atticus. And there's a man who leaves the trial with feeling that his dignity's been taken away and really angry. And so then he takes that is a catalyst for a future scene, which then is a catalyst for the Boo Radley mystery.
Why is it if you read about this book, read about the adaptations of it, it always says that it celebrates the fact that good will triumph or that good will prevail, even if a sort of a courtroom drama may not come out the right way? Where is it that we see the sort of enduring goodness?
Well, I think we see it in small. It's like when Miss Maudie at the end, she says, I was sitting in the trial and I thought to myself, he's not going to win. But maybe we're taking a little step. A little step along the way. If somebody doesn't stand up and speak the truth, then goodness will never have a chance. And he took that first step. He took the step to stand up and defend that man, even though early on in the play, and we heard it in, or we'll hear it in one of the scenes today, Scout says, are we going to win it? And he says, no, we're not, honey. And that's long before the trial even takes place. But the good survives because the kids see, and hopefully they start another generation of new steps that we can take. And some of the adults are changed by it, too.
Well, Atticus has, you know, he is this semi-divine figure by some accounts, although flawed in the eyes of his son, at least for a time. He has gone up against this community. The people are against him even taking on this case. He loses the case. I don't think we're tipping any hands here.
Right.
How does it play out in terms of optimism regarding Atticus and the community?
I think Atticus attempts, again, in that court speech that Roseanne talked about, to make everyone realize that in this place, in this courtroom, there is a sense of reverence, that outside we have a divide, a horrible divide, but in this one place we all come to, we hope and pray, and our country is founded on this, that this is the room where each of us are equal. And I think it's brilliant and hopefully a concept that the people of the town again and the next generation of children are going to take forward, that just realize here we all are equal.
And that's the optimism for our time today, too.
And the power of the individual when Scout speaks up to what otherwise would stay a faceless mob.
It sometimes
takes
the system a while to come around to the thinking of individuals.
Right, right. And that's a classic scene, too, when they all arrive as a group. And because she addresses one of them and on a personal level, they then all lose their group mentality and find themselves in an individual situation that has compassion and understanding.
Well, thank you for sharing just some of the facets of this enduring novel and film and, of course, play, which is what we're about here with the Children's Theater of Madison production of To Kill a Mockingbird. We've been talking with the director, Roseanne Sheridan, and with cast members. And thanks again, one and all, for coming and being part of University of the Air today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.